Good morning. Welcome to Dig in the Dirt.
I'm Ann Goldine, and this week we're going to talk about all things plant. My guest is Sean Hogan. He is the owner of Sistis Nursery on Sobey Island. He's a garden designer and a writer. Good morning, Sean.
Good morning.
Okay, so let's start with, did you guys have any damage in the last week? We've had flooding in different places. Up on Mount Hood, all along the coast. Did Sobey's Island get, or anywhere that you...
No, I mean, as one crosses the bridge over onto the island, it does look a little bit like the island might be sinking, but we're told it's not. It's fine. We're in a little bit of a rain shadow there, so unless the Columbia River does something, we'd rather it not. We're usually in pretty good shape.
Oh, okay. So it's not, no damage. The nursery's fine?
Yeah.
Oh, good.
Yeah, exactly. So luckily we don't live in Sandy at the moment.
Yeah. So. Sandy's not doing zigzags, not too good. That Lolo Road is...
Exactly, and it's funny. That's a place we have been making a lot of manzanita selections of late. So I've been on that road a number of times in the last couple of months.
You mean as in digging?
Not digging, but doing cuttings.
Oh, great. So you can actually make new manzanitas from cuttings?
Yeah, that's how they do it, and it's pretty exciting. That's been a sort of a fixation of ours in the last couple of years.
And so is it... So then you take a cutting and then you root it.
Exactly.
How long does it take?
Well, you know, it's funny. When one is looking at a plant out there in the wild and thinking, that looks like it might be nice in the garden, there's so many tests, especially with a native plant, it has to go through. Sometimes they don't root well. Sometimes they hate it on our little mist bench. Sometimes they don't want to be in a nursery. Sometimes they look really awful in a garden. So they have about 8 or 10 tests to pass. And then a few years later, we can, if we're lucky, say, this is a great plant. So it's really variable.
But manzanita's winning?
But the manzanitas, we're doing about 70 or so new selections this year, and about 50 of them are going through their, you know, first-year tests. And if I can just stop pulling them from their little pumice pots and seeing if they've rooted and probably breaking the roots off when I do it, then maybe we'll have some go.
Well, manzanita is certainly a plant that's beautiful in any landscape you can get it to grow in.
Absolutely, and way underused.
Yeah, I think it's maybe too wet here.
Well, you know, it's funny. They are really variable. Many of them can take almost all the water in the world in the winter. It's just in the summer they don't want it.
Oh, well they should be fine most years.
They are
years.
Fine, exactly. You know, of course, thus the town Manzanita on the coast. So it's... you know, the main thing is we try to select some that can actually take a little bit of accidental summer garden water, because we all do that once in a while. It's difficult not to nurture.
Right. Yeah, that's funny that we kill it with kindness.
Exactly.
So are there other natives that would be great to explore?
Oh, you know, absolutely. Sometimes it's kind of funny that we start really wanting to use native plants to be helpful to the pollinators and just sort of do the right thing. And sometimes it's almost like a punishment garden. It's kind of funny.
Who's being punished, the plants?
Somehow I think sometimes we plant native plants out of guilt, and and what we plant sometimes looks like we've done it out of guilt.
Oh, God.
So I'd like to be one who says that using native plants in the garden really can be every bit as stylized and beautiful as, you know, using any other plant. And, you know, I think with some of those... Just imagine the things that are native, even right along the coast, that are in flower right now. All the different currants, a lot of them are starting to come out. The silk tassels, the garryas, are absolutely amazing. And there's Garrya elliptica, the coast silk tassel, that's one of our most beautiful natives. And it's, you know, it's right there on every cliff from Tillamook South. Some of the redwood sorrels, Oxalis oregana, amazing ground covers, and the coastal forms actually grow like crazy all winter. And a lot of them, we've selected a number of clones that we've named, but, you know, they're all good.
Mm-hmm.
And the nice thing is, not only do they look lush and beautiful all winter, but, you know, in mild spells will flower, and you know, pretty good plants. Same with some of the coyote bush, the bacchus. They're very nice, and they're native from actually Central Baja to Astoria, on sort of all, and the nice thing is they make dense mounds along the coast, and they flower in January and February.
This is the coyote bush?
Yeah.
I've never even heard of it.
It's if you go out, oh, say, anywhere west of Warrenton, or almost anywhere.
Well, wait, Warrenton is about as west as it gets.
Yes, exactly. But I mean, right along the water.
Okay.
It's not aquatic or anything, but you know, west, or as you're driving, for instance, south, when you start to get into some of the steep terrain, just look on the cliffs and the rocky spots, and you'll see these very dense, green, round shrubs, and a lot of them right now should have these little sort of pale yellow paintbrush flowers on them.
Oh.
And they're, the fragrance, you know, sometimes with plants, there's a slight difference between, say, fragrance and odor.
Mm.
And sometimes these could be said to have both. But actually, I think the flowers smell like grandma's attic. I don't know what that means, but it smells like old magazines. And
Right. No, but I know what that smell is.
Yeah. But what I can say, the pollinators love them.
Oh.
So if you want to see every little native bee there is, plant a Bacchus.
Okay, now, people might get the impression they should go to the beach and dig up some of these plants.
No, certainly not.
Okay, how do you get them?
Well, there are, certainly good garden centers will have a section of natives.
Okay.
And they should have, for instance, coyote bush in their repertoire.
Mm-hmm. Would these be hybrids?
Well, most of them would not be hybrids, but they would be selections. So, for instance, years ago on the Central Oregon coast, we took cuttings of three different plants that were growing as cushions. And meaning, you know, plants are really variable, and we're always looking for things that have attributes that we tend to like. And these, instead of being rangy shrubs, were very low-mounding creatures. So we took cuttings. Of the three different plants we took cuttings of, two of them are good, we think, and one we named Creeping Green, and the other is Blue Mound. And Creeping Green we've used the most of because it gets about 3 feet tall, but very dense, good spiller, good sort of sand holder, for instance.
Mm.
And I think, you know, especially with a plant that's native from Baja to northern Oregon, I like having things that have some local names on them. Not that Creeping Green is local, but, selections that are from sort of our part of the woods.
Mm-hmm. Well, also, it's likely to be successful.
Yes, absolutely.
And it sounds like pretty much anyone that would be listening to this program.
Right.
At least who's on the West Coast would
probably
be fine. I forget, I do have listeners in other parts of the world.
All right.
Through that streaming.
And let me know if there are... you know, great in Astoria and Kazakhstan.
will there be enough rain in the winter in Kazakhstan?
Yes.
Oh, great. Oh, okay. All right. So let's talk about a couple other natives that might be great to look for this season or in the spring to plant for next year.
Oh, absolutely. I think one good plant, and more available at various nurseries, are some of the native trilliums. The coastal trillium, it's not native as far north as Astoria, but on the south coast it is. It's called Trillium chloropetalum. And there's one in Oregon called, and this won't be on the quiz, but it's called Kurabayashi.
Ooh, what a nice name. That sounds Japanese.
Well, it was named by a Japanese botanist that a great Northwest plantsman showed this plant in, I believe, 1972. But that aside, this is a creature that their little noses are poking out of the ground now, and often on the coast, certainly by early February, they'll be in full flower. And they have anywhere from burgundy to golden flowers and leaves that are mottled with purple.
I know this.
They're really long flowers. Often you'll still have flowers going in June and July.
Okay,
at least the leaves will be going in July.
Is this a cultivar or this is the... the species name?
There are several cultivars, but the species are either Chloropetalum, C-H-L-O-R-O, or Kurabayashi, which I couldn't spell if it were to save my life.
Kurabayashi.
Right.
Okay.
But there are a number of cultivars that have been selected out now, but several places are growing them. I think, you know, with a lot of these natives, especially things like trilliums, the one thing you must ask when approaching a nursery is, they have to promise you while looking you directly in the eye that none of these things were taken from the wild.
Mm-hmm.
That's very important. And it makes them more expensive. Our Trillium Kuribayashis, we have a batch flowering for the first time this year that we planted from seed in 2004.
Whoa.
So, they're not going to be as cheap as petunias.
Right. No, these are a long-term commitment on the part of the grower.
The grower and the owner.
Yeah, okay.
They should come with little papers with gold writing on them. There are other things also that are a bit easier to come by. Some of our local Oregon grapes.
Okay, wait. Before we leave the Trillium,
sure,
I want to talk about... Trillium is like an understory plant.
Yeah.
That you're not going to put it out in full sun.
They
right?
could probably be in at least dappled shade, almost full sun on the coast.
Okay.
Because you know,
not inland. Not inland.
Probably not inland. They're... But because most of their growing is in winter and spring, before it gets hot inland, they'll do surprisingly well with a lot of sun.
Oh, okay. And well, maybe we'll have some. I don't know. Last year we certainly didn't.
Exactly, yes. Shade, yes, all the time.
Right. Of course, this might be the year when we actually have a sunny summer on the coast.
Exactly, or that one day of 100 degrees and then back to 61.
Right. So, okay, some cool places. So what's the next one?
Well, a couple of things have come to mind, and I have not seen a lot of two things. One, Pacific Coast iris along the coast. And I will often tell people they should be grown only because we can grow them and nobody else can. They cannot take the freezing that happens in cold climates, and they can't take climates that get rain in the summer. So here we have at least a dozen species growing in western Oregon and northern California, every color of the iris rainbow, evergreen, and then people have been busy hybridizing them. They're stunning. And if you go probably about Newport South, our most common one is Douglasiana, the Douglas iris.
Mm-hmm.
And every meadow and sea stack, you see them flowering anywhere from late winter to early summer. But really, just ask for Pacific Coast iris, and it is amazing what you can find. Or Google them, because there are some very good growers around the West.
So you said all different colors. I'm thinking of the purple. That must be the Douglas.
Douglas are purple, but actually there's a place near Langlois where they hybridize with one of the inland ones, and you get purples and oranges and whites and yellows and pinks and rusts, and you name it.
Wow.
So they're, just absolutely stunning plants. And the nice thing about most of them is that they're very evergreen. So while they're not in flower, you get a very nice evergreen, kind of shiny grass-looking thing.
Mm-hmm.
Wonderful for sort of understory. If you have a native garden, you're growing things like ceanothus or manzanitas or you name it, myricas, the bayberries,
mm-hmm.
they make a wonderful matrix underneath and pretty carefree. Really, the only baggage I can think of is not overwatering in the summer, and they really only want to be divided in October, November. They just kind of get one set of roots a year, and if you divide them in the fall, they're happy campers.
Would they ever get mixed up with like bearded irises? Do they ever like get crossed or do anything like that? I mean, would they if your garden is full of other kinds of irises? Whatever,
right.
Siberian irises, Japanese iris, or bearded iris, would that happen?
They seem to be genetically closest to the Siberian irises. I have never heard of a bearded iris and a Pacific Coast iris dating.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they might date, but they've never had kids.
Okay, safe sex only.
Exactly.
All right.
But some people are breeding Siberian irises with the native ones. But I got to tell you, the only reason to do that is if you don't live in Oregon. If you live in some place that nobody should live, like Kansas. Because, sorry to anybody who's streaming from Kansas, but really, there really is hardly a better group of plants with better garden attributes than the Pacific Coast iris.
Just the way it is.
Just the way they are, mm-hmm. and various hybrids that have been made from them. So the perfect kind of thing for those that like that kind of thing, as they say.
Mm-hmm. That sounds good. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk more. We'll talk about some other new things that are going on. I'm Ann Goldine, and I'm with Sean Hogan, the owner of Sis's Nursery and a garden designer. If you're just joining the conversation, This is Dig in the Dirt, and I'm with Sean Hogan. He is the owner of Cistus Nursery on Sovie Island and a garden designer. All right, so we left talking about growing Pacific Coast iris and their relatives, and there are lots of other irises, but we're on the natives. All right, so let's move on.
Yeah, we don't have to stay there.
No. Oh, there are lots of other options.
Exactly.
So, have you got another cool plant we should look at?
Well, you know, it's funny. It's kind of fun to be seasonal about these things, and here we are in January, and I think one of the most interesting plants that, especially along the coast, a lot of them do really well, are some of the Protea family creatures that are both from South Africa and Australia. Some of the toughest, and it's good to plant some of these things that can take, you know, a 10-year frost or freeze. Grevilleas, they're really amazing plants, and you know, a lot of them along the coast are in flower right now. So they're relatives of those sort of pine cone looking flowers you see in florists that are the true Proteas of South Africa. These tend to have smaller flowers on really variable shrubs. Some of them look like spruce needles and dark green. Some of them have oval leaves that are kind of silver. But many of them will flower from October or November right through the spring. And not only do they add a lot of, you know, winter garden color, but the hummingbirds think you're really great if you plant them.
Mm-hmm. And they're readily available?
They are, more and more. You know, most garden centers will have at least a few. I know, you know, we carry at least a dozen or so at any given point.
Okay, let's say I listen to this program. I'm going shopping today.
Right.
Can I put it in the ground today?
If you live on the... I recommend planting in the winter almost anything just because you've got the rest of the rainy season for roots to get established
mm-hmm.
before it gets dry
okay.
in the spring, summer. However, you know, with the funny winters we've had the last few, some plants that are a little more tender, we put an asterisk by, and that would be, I think it's always better to plant now, but be ready with a burlap sack should we get a late frost. right now, it's looking, you know, mild for the next 2 or 3 weeks, which puts us out of the danger zone.
Mm-hmm.
So,
but then we might have a freeze, and that would be the time if you've just planted something to cover that.
Exactly.
So, but, and you think a burlap bag is adequate?
You know, I think for the most part, anything we might get after this, you'll come after me if something else happens. But
that's right. February can be really deadly.
Exactly. But, you know, really, after the first week of February, our record lows go so high that, you know, even in Portland, chances are anything more than a little frost on the windshield would be, you know, almost unheard of.
Mm-hmm.
So, of course, I say that with the strange winters we've been having. The blizzard of April will be...
right, will be haunting you.
Right, but for the most part, if unless the nurseries have grown them inside a hot greenhouse, they could be transferred to the garden now or very soon with really no problem at all.
Well, I guess the other thing is if you're not sure how it was grown, you could put it on the porch, you know,
yes.
go through a process of hardening it.
Right, pull it in,
out,
should it get really cold and that kind of thing. But, you know, they kind of... Well, they'll often say, don't shop while you're hungry, and
mm-hmm.
I disagree. I think you get all the best stuff when you're hungry. And, you know, for winter flowering things especially, shop now.
Because
this is when they're going. And it's amazing. You know, we get busy with other things in the winter and don't realize that a really important gardening season is in our midst.
Well, yeah, I think people just don't even think of it. It's like the garden is just shut out.
Right.
You know, it's totally uninteresting. I have virtually no lawn left from a mole.
Oh.
And I don't even want to look left or right when I walk through the yard.
Right.
It's like, it's mud mounds everywhere.
Oh. Especially if some of your favorite bulbs are resting on top of those.
Yes,
moles.
They are. Yeah, it's a mess. And I hadn't even thought about the possibility that anything might be blooming or even thinking about poking up. So I should really revise my thinking.
Oh, you know, so many things. You know, from all the winter crocus to... you name it. If there's a spot in the garden that you view when coming to and from whatever you do outside the house,
mm-hmm.
picture views from the windows, you really could have a riot of color, you know, from November through February.
I'm for that.
Yeah.
So are there others in the Protea family?
Well, there are a few things on the coast. Some of the Banksias, which are, for the most part, larger shrubs with flowers that look more like strange cobs of corn.
Oh.
And strangely enough, when they flower, the fragrance of the flower is kind of like baking bread. I've kind of imagined what might pollinate those plants. But actually, I think they're sunbird pollinated, but maybe little bakers come around. So some of those are great. I'm trying to think of other things in that family that are good. There are some things called lomatias that are quite beautiful shrubs. They're both in Chile and Australia. My favorite of all of them is one called Myricoides, because it looks like the myrica that grows along the coast. But it has kind of a turquoise blue cast to the leaf, and which is very pretty at any time of the year. And I think they should use them along highways instead of reflectors because of the way the leaves reflect. And it's more of a late winter to spring flower, wonderful clusters of white flowers that smell intensely of honey.
So that sounds great.
Those are definitely worth it. And from the same part of the world, but not related, some of the leptospermums, the tea trees, are absolutely wonderful.
Lepto.
And it's Lepto.
Oh, lepto.
Right.
That sounds, what is lepto? Isn't that like...
I believe wolf? It's exposed.
Exposed. Oh, okay.
I'll have to look. I might be totally wrong. There are some linguists out there listening right now.
I know they're
busy
dying.
Sending you an email.
right. They're dying with my Latin or Greek interpretation.
Maybe it means English spotted. Is a second language, let alone Latin. So.
Maybe it means spotted. I don't know.
Right.
Anyway, so what are they like?
There are a couple of species in New Zealand. And a lot of the tea trees you'll see, sort of central coastal Oregon gardens, south through California, they come in all kinds of bright reds and pinks. On the northern Oregon coast, every once in a while they'll get hammered by a winter, although I think still worth planting. And those are Leptospermum scoparium, which means don't plant north of Newport in Latin.
I'm writing that down.
There are a whole bunch of others, most of them Australian.
Oh.
And there's one called Lenidrum, meaning woolly, that has a stunning silver leaf with white flowers, and another one called Grandifolium, which means way big leaves. And that one will become a small tree. And I've got one in my front garden here, actually growing over a lomatia, and it's, 15 feet now. With the leaves are about a half an inch, totally silver, and the bark is a shredding gold. So every time of the year, it's gorgeous. And with a little bit of a breeze, and I know occasionally there's a slight breeze along the coast, so every time the branches move, you get this flash of silver. And then several times a year, late winter, late spring, and autumn, you get this flush of sweetly scented white flowers. So look for some of the leptospermums, and some of them might be mail order, but definitely worth looking for. The one I mentioned prior, Lenidrum, is much slower growing, and eventually 8 to 10 feet. And some of them have weeping branches. And
they sound fabulous.
They're very nice. I tend to almost always lean toward foliage first. And if it flowers, that's just a bonus. Realizing, though, that not everyone feels that way.
If you only have flowering things, you don't. You're going to have times where you have nothing.
Exactly. And there's so much good color and texture with leaves and architectural shapes of plants that, to me, flowers can enhance that a lot. But, you can have a full and complete garden in January, looking out the window, even without flowers.
Right. I mostly have this hedge of rhodies to look at. At least they're leaves, but they're all pretty much the same.
Well, they make a good trellis.
Oh, I see. And what are we putting on the trellis?
Anything that covers the rhododendron, but that's just a bias.
Well, you know, in the summer, what I have covering them is that wild cucumber.
The Mara, yeah.
That lovely weed.
Yeah.
And of course, bindweed.
Exactly.
And blackberries. That's what I fight with.
Well, it's a nice combination, and you're doing something for the wildlife. And at least the Mara's a native, so... You know, you can say I'm providing habitat for a native plant.
Well, actually, I pull it up as often as I can.
Yeah.
It doesn't seem to mind.
No. Well, they have tubers the size of a Volkswagen, apparently, so.
Oh, God.
They've got lots of storage available.
Well, and I'm afraid to dig because, you know, the roots of the rhodies are so shallow, I think I made, you know, they're coming right up through the...
Right.
So I just take them off at the ground.
Or that, and you can disturb the moles.
Disturb the moles. Oh, God.
You don't want to do that.
No. I do. I tried X-Lax. I tried a trap. The trap tripped, but no catching of mole, and the X-Lax, well, I don't know. We'll see if, where do the moles go in the winter?
To your lawn, actually.
Okay, well, but that's where it was before.
Right, exactly.
No, so they're still there?
Yeah, oh, they hang out, I think. I think they might slow down a little bit, but I imagine that most of the year, west of the Cascades and the like, they're quite happy to just be moles. Eating roots and bulbs and
so
all of that.
They don't eat worms, then?
You know, I must admit, there are voles and moles, and I believe moles...
Are vegetarians.
It might be the voles that are vegetarian. I certainly know that the voles come above ground and eat my formiums, so I know at least they're semi-vegetarian. Either way, they do a lot of root disturbance.
Yeah. Yes. No, I'm pretty sure I have moles, because it used to be that my cats would get them and bring them as presents, and
right.
they've lost interest.
That's, if they have too good a life, that's what I find.
I know, I overfeed them, that's the problem.
Yeah.
Now they'd rather get birds, which drives me nuts.
Right.
Yeah, occasional bats.
Yes, exactly.
They do get rats and mice, that's good. But the mole is destroying the yard. I think I may just take out the rest of the lawn and do something else.
That's, we have found that doing some... lateral screens have worked in the garden. It just thwarts them a little bit.
Lateral? What's a lateral screen?
Well, I wish we had done this a little bit more, but we have had both a vole and mole problem in our display gardens on Savi Island, and I, you know, mostly realize that when my favorite things don't come up in the spring or whenever. But some of the bulbs we've planted in essentially strainer-like objects that are essentially very primitive. Sort of wire mesh, and that way they can't get into them.
Oh, got it. All right. You have been listening to Dig in the Dirt. My guest is Sean Hogan. He is the owner of Sista's Nursery and a garden designer. Well, we are done for now, but you are coming to Astoria in April for to be the keynote speaker at the Clatsop County Master Gardener Spring Seminar.
Right.
Do you know what you're going to talk about?
I have no idea.
Going to be...
I pretty much do.
You want to share?
Sure,
okay.
Absolutely. I've always been absolutely enthralled with all the things that are growable along the coast. So I am going to concentrate on things for, you know, especially year-round interest that are absolutely at their best on the coast.
Oh, that sounds great.
Instead
of us importing from around the world...
Exactly.
Take it from there.
Or even import it from around the world. Just, you know, have it at home.
Right. That's great. Well, thank you very much, Sean.
Absolutely.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Next week, Usha Honeyman, who is a naturopathic physician and chiropractic physician, will be here. She is somewhat of an expert on Lyme disease. We'll talk about Lyme disease, the prevalence, the diagnosis, and appropriate treatments.